This program presented for our audience of blind and print-impaired folks by the North Carolina Reading Service. It is titled Indie Week, and it's a weekly journal. And I'm John Feddersen, reading the current issue, which is dated April the 6th of 2023. And as always, we flash back and forth between the print edition of Indie Week and IndieWeek.com, which has occasionally more up-to-date published stories. Let's leave it at that. But this first one from the print edition by Gwyneth Bernier, Durham Public School articles, is the title on the cover page of the print edition, Left Behind. On his first day at Durham Technical Community College in September of 2021, 19-year-old freshman Shahid Ali was lost in every sense of the word. He wandered around campus, furiously typing building names into his Google Translate app, grabbing random students and professors he insistently pointed at his schedule. With pitying smiles, they chirped incomprehensible phrases in English too quickly for him to understand and shuffled along with their day, leaving him bewildered. The frenzy of colorful banners, student organizations, and professors whirred around him. Everyone seemed to know exactly where to go and what to do. Ali arrived at his first class with 5 minutes left in the period, holding back tears. And he recalls with a shudder, "That's a hard memory. I tried to keep smiling and stay positive like I always do, but it was hard." When Ali fled Afghanistan as a refugee in 2017, he and his family were settled to the refugee hotspot of Durham, North Carolina, just 2 months after his plane touched down at RDU Airport. Ali started as a freshman at Jordan High School, knowing only a few words of English. When he graduated, he had barely learned a few more. Ali's story is typical of the fastest-growing student group in Durham, English learners. Students from other countries who speak a language other than English at home. This year, English learners make up 1 in every 6 students in Durham Public Schools. 1 in 6. Yet they lag far behind their peers in academic achievement, struggling with basic English comprehension. Last year, test scores among DP schools, English learners were amongst the lowest in the state, 106th. Of 115 districts, while scores for the white students were the 4th best in the state. Meanwhile, performance by non-white English-speaking students was in the middle of the pack. This is despite the fact that the Durham school system was challenged in court 5 years ago over its service to English learners. DPS Assistant Superintendent Stacey Stewart says the school district is aware of the poor performance by English learners and is putting new improvements in place in response. Moving forward, we have a plan based on research to increase English learner student performance and bring parents into conversation. When Ali started his freshman year at Jordan, he only spoke Pashto, one of Afghanistan's 2 official languages. Trekking miles through Afghanistan's mountainous terrain to school with his younger sister came naturally to Ali. Navigating DPS route maps to find where to catch the bus, not so much. He says, "Everything was so different and I didn't know anybody. The people at Durham Public Schools, they don't really make an effort to make sure the families and students understand where to go or what to do." His struggles continued even after he figured out how to get to class. And he says, "My English as a second language teacher just talked at me and wrote things on the board rather than helping me participate like I did at school in Afghanistan. I didn't know enough English to ask my teachers to slow down or tell them I couldn't understand. I'm not sure they even noticed or cared." His ESL courses frustrated him to the point he sought other avenues of learning. He remembers, "My locker neighbor Ryan and I would skip lunch most days so he could tutor me. On the days he couldn't, I would watch Friends in the bathroom on my phone with Pashto subtitles. That was much more helpful for me to learn English than my teachers were. At least helped me get by in school." Integrated classes like art and gym were even worse and made him want to stop going to school altogether. He says, when we would play soccer in gym class, I would sometimes see the other kids make fun of me or not want to pick me for their teams because of my accent. My gym teacher pretended it was not happening. By the end of senior year, he could not read at a second grade level, yet he was still permitted to graduate from high school in 2021. Paradoxically, while few English learners and DPS even reach basic academic proficiency, they still graduate on time. 61% graduated in 4 years from DPS in 2022. The numbers do not surprise Assistant Superintendent Stewart. She said that we've seen the data, and this is unfortunate. We all have work to do. It's not just the job of the ESL teachers. From K-12, we're implementing processes and strategies so that students are engaged, excited, and coming to school, immersed in classroom work and overall language development. Stewart also pointed to the COVID pandemic as a factor in poor student performance. Quote, the biggest challenge at this moment is the challenge of mitigating COVID-19. How do we make up for learning loss from students being online? But Durham Public Schools leadership recognized achievement gaps within the system prior to the pandemic. At the end of 2017, Superintendent Pascal Mubenga announced a 5-year strategic plan to bridge the learning gap between the district's high and low performing student group. The plan called for at least 60% of all DPS students to achieve grade-level reading and math proficiency on end-of-grade tests by the end of 2023. At a district-wide administration meeting in 2021, Mubenga called the strategic plan a powerful spark in the school system post-pandemic. He said, with a booming voice to snaps and whoops from the audience, the plan creates a vision of equity in which students' identifiers are no longer an accurate predictor of their academic outcomes. It marks a new beginning for Durham schools that will lift up every student without exception. Yet gaps persist. Last year, school year, less than a fifth of English learners at Durham Public Schools had reading and math scores at grade level. Less than one-fifth, compared to 80% of its white students and half its non-white English-speaking students. During equity discussions at school board meetings, administrators mentioned English learners infrequently compared with other groups, despite English learners being the lowest performing group by a wide margin. English learners also received little attention in the school system budget. This year, out of a $684 million annual budget, $5 million was specifically allocated for English learners. In school board meetings, district administrators have said inadequate funding and a linguistically diverse population explain English learners' weak academic performance. Now, Durham Public Schools is indeed linguistically diverse. The vast majority of these populations speak Spanish, but the remaining students speak a wide variety of other languages, including Arabic, Farsi, French, Vietnamese, and Mandarin. The district currently employs 18 Spanish translators. There are no translators on staff for languages other than Spanish. Still, other North Carolina school districts have similarly large and diverse populations. Compared with students in these districts, English learners at Durham Public Schools perform significantly worse. At Charlotte-Mecklenburg, for instance, non-English speakers make up nearly one-third of the total student body and speak 204 different languages. Yet, the English learners there display significantly higher year-end test scores than in Durham. Stewart said in response, "We're not happy with the data from last year. We know that COVID negatively impacted our efforts." Stewart also said the district has plans to improve programs for English learners, including a new family academy that provides foreign-born parents and students with additional in-person instruction on weekends. Quote, In January, we started to implement school improvement plans and inspections on a day-to-day basis. These include 4 points tested on year-end exams: English reading, writing, speaking, and listening comprehension. We're also working on the new English Learner Prep and Family Academy. Civil rights lawyer William Tobin thinks these are important steps, but too little too late. For more than a decade, Tobin ran Duke University's Citizenship Lab, a volunteer tutoring program that served hundreds of refugee students in Durham, including Ali. Tobin initiated the aforementioned 2018 lawsuit against DPS on behalf of a Riverside High School English learner student. By June of his senior year, the student was reading at a first grade level. Nevertheless, he was granted a high school diploma. The lawsuit, which was ultimately settled out of court, resulted in Durham Public Schools paying for a year of remedial English instruction for the student at Durham Tech. And Tobin says not much has changed since the lawsuit was settled out of court. Quote, key metrics of English learners' academic success in the school system are still just as bad and have never been in the neighborhood of okay. What DPS still desperately needs help with is the most basic and vexing challenge: assistance on how all of us can live out every day, and not just talk about and mentally agree with, the truth that English learner students are intelligent and going places. The lawsuit was settled before Ali finished his sophomore year in high school, yet Ali still didn't learn English in high school. And that wasn't the only way the system failed him. He also wanted to learn skills like basic algebra that would open doors for him in college and career. As an English learner, Ali was shunted into English as a second language course with other English learners and isolated from the rest of the student body. These courses are intended to benefit non-native speakers with a slower pace and greater focus on vocabulary. However, the courses are meant to be transitory, lasting for a year or two upon a student's arrival. They don't cover all the content needed to prepare students for standardized tests and the rigors of a college education. At DPS, English learners exit English as a second language course by scoring high enough on year-end exams. Unfortunately, most do not make enough progress on these exams to do so. As a result, most of these learners miss out on a wide range of courses. This lack of access to key knowledge bases severely limits their college and career options. Azana Green says communication issues are a big part of the problem. She saw that firsthand while working at the Lincoln Community Health Center, which provides health care and social services for marginalized groups in Durham, including migrants. According to Green, English learners' families were often the last to know about academic opportunities and classes, resulting in those students being shut out or missing deadlines. She said with a sigh, Durham Public Schools would call newcomer families from the hours of 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., unannounced, and expect the parents to have several hours to work through forms. That's just not possible for a family trying to get on their feet with a mom and dad respectively working long hours as a nail technician and a cab driver. From student registration to assessments to parent-teacher conferences, there was way too much red tape. They had to know that if I, a native English speaker, found the forms confusing, English learner families would too. But lack of communication wasn't the only issue. The messages the school system did send were problematic, too. In the fall of his senior year, Ali realized he was only enrolled in 3 classes rather than the typical 4. He brought up his concern with his guidance counselor. She dismissed his worries. Quote, my counselor said it wasn't a problem because I would still graduate with the required number of credits. But I knew it meant I wouldn't meet the requirements for college admissions. She didn't see a problem because I already had a job at Lowe's. During high school, he began working part-time hours as a Lowe's cashier. He didn't see it as a permanent career, just a way to save money for college. Ali refused to let himself be talked into failure. Now he strolls around Durham Tech's campus, joking in English with friends. Confident in his ability to pick up new languages, he's on his way to Spanish 101. He's proud of becoming fully proficient in English in 2 years at community college. He plans to transfer UNC Greensboro next fall to pursue computer science. But it'll take him 3 years to obtain a 2-year degree from Durham Tech before transferring, and that third year will cost him an extra $4,000 in tuition money. It's not just Ali. One in five English learners who graduate from Durham head on to college, yet they face several years and thousands of dollars in setbacks because they often can't enroll in college courses immediately after graduation. Adam Burns has taught remedial English courses at Durham Tech since 2016. Most English learners from school districts across North Carolina matriculate directly into credit-bearing courses, he says. In contrast, he says, Durham English learners typically must take remedial courses first. Even within remedial courses, Burns says English learners from Durham have weaker language skills than other students. He says, my colleagues and I find it distressing that these students who have taken 4 years of high school come to Durham Tech with no knowledge of simple English capitalization and punctuation rules. Those of us who have volunteered at DPS in our free time know it's because the teachers and administration there share a rubber stamp mentality. For them, it's about letting English learners pass and move on without insisting they master basic English skills. There's zero accountability. Ali took Burns' class in his freshman year, 2021. By the end of that semester, he was overjoyed to be able to read articles and watch the news in English. How did Ali become English proficient in just 1 year at Durham Tech, when he was unable to do so at Durham Public Schools in 4? Burns cites 2 key factors, faculty experience and teaching style. He says, in 2012, when the English learner population really started growing, English as a second language department director Paula Wilder started to recruit and retain incredible talent at Durham Tech. Many of our 17 faculty members earned doctoral degrees, speak a variety of languages, and have considerable experience teaching language overseas. Burns himself spent years teaching English in Beijing, China. Some experienced teachers may be drawn to teaching at a college level rather than K-12, but professors at Durham Tech also take a totally different approach to teaching English. Burns says, in line with current research, we avoid lectures and instead focus on a student-centered approach that emphasizes individual participation and group activities. We also carefully monitor student progress. I would never pass a student who didn't have the tools to succeed. Durham Tech professors like Burns have recommended DPS adopt its methodology, yet the school system has not yet changed its approach. Meanwhile, more students like Ali keep arriving at the school's doorstep. One of those students is Ali's little sister, Farista. He says, I worry for my sister Farista, who still goes to high school in Jordan. I try to help her with English at home. She wants to go to medical school to be a doctor, but I'm scared she won't get the chance. This problem isn't going away soon. Currently, English learners make up roughly 10% of all U.S. public school students, and that number is expected to hit 25% nationwide by the end of this decade. 25%. These figures don't have to mean impending doom. Despite the obstacles he's faced, Ali is a testament to what's possible. He's excited about his upcoming graduation from Durham Tech in May. This time, he says, I'll be able to understand the speeches. More from Durham, Alina Geller, article on the SCAD, S-C-A-D proposal. And Durham Habitat says its involvement with the proposal was enacted by a third party. In a Monday letter addressed to Durham City Council and Board of County Commissioners, a spokesperson for Habitat of Humanity of Durham stated the organization did not authorize its co-sponsorship role in this proposed SCAD text amendment to Durham's zoning ordinance. Carlina Dionanen, chair of Durham Habitat's Board of Directors, wrote, quote, after a thorough review of our records and multiple conversations with involved parties, the organization had learned that its involvement in the whole proposal was enacted through an unauthorized third party. SCAD, which stands for Simplifying Codes for Affordable Development, was submitted for approval in May of 2021 and identifies Raleigh-based developer Jim Anthony and Durham Habitat as co-applicants. But Dionanen wrote, no staff member or officer of Habitat of Durham authorized our association with or sponsorship of the proposal or related amendments. In addition, it's come to our attention that the same third party has been speaking and negotiating on behalf of Habitat of Durham with members of City Council as it relates to SCAD. This communication was not authorized, and any representations, potential commitments, or promises made on our behalf were not permitted by Durham Habitat. She wrote, Durham Habitat expressed support for some elements of the proposal at its outset, but based on the above information regarding this third-party unauthorization, Habitat cannot support the SCAD documents. The letter comes several weeks after Habitat requested its name be removed from all documents regarding SCAD process and application in a March 7th memo. Proponents say SCAD would broaden affordable housing opportunities in Durham by relaxing regulatory compliance and offering new incentive for developers. Opponents say the proposal, which is unprecedented in length, would worsen gentrification and displacement and argue that its approval would set a troubling precedent for allowing developers undue access to the ordinance that regulates their work and profits. In the months since SCAD was submitted for approval, its proponents have consistently pointed to the co-sponsorship of Habitat, one of the city's most reliable providers of affordable home ownership opportunities, as corroboration that the proposal was made in good faith. The City Council was originally scheduled to cast votes on SCAD following a public hearing at its March 20th meeting. But after three council members, Didriana Freeman, Monique Holsey-Hyman, and Mayor Elaine O'Neill, said during the meeting they needed more time to comprehend the complexities, the council decided in a 4-3 vote they would postpone that SCAD hearing and move the vote to May 1st. Council members Williams, Jillian Johnson, and Javier Caballero voted no on the postponement. Other co-applicants have not been publicly identified, and Anthony has not responded to the Indy's previous requests for comments on SCAD. Well, one or two articles ago, I read about Durham Public Schools, and Jenny Coldren has written this other op-ed, actually, about exceptional child support in Durham. Too many parents know how hard it is to watch their child struggle in school. Often, with the guidance of school staff, we begin the exceptional child EC process. You're given a parent's handbook that could rival Tolstoy's War and Peace in length. The assessment begins and you wait. You think you know what you're getting into, but nothing could prepare you for that results meeting. You hear a lot of numbers, scale scores, standard scores, T scores, and percentiles. The first time I was a parent in one of those meetings was 4 years ago, and I'm still digesting some of the information presented, but there's one thing that will make sure you understand. Your child has, and by extension you have, rights. Rights to an education that acknowledges your child's neurodiversity, accommodates their needs, and as necessary, modifies the curriculum to meet those needs. Your child gets an individualized Education Plan, an IEP, and that I is the most important part. Nobody tells you that North Carolina doesn't provide a sound basic education for neurotypical students, much less their neurodivergent students. If you watch the applications meetings, they plainly discuss that the state gives districts a certain amount for every student with disabilities, unless that's more than 13% of the student population. Since the average across all North Carolina school districts is 14%, you can imagine it often is. Nobody tells you that many schools don't have EC teachers right now. You hear the promise that your child's need will be met without the acknowledgement that there are 40 vacancies for EC teachers and 42 EC other vacancies across Durham Public Schools. They don't tell you that this legal document will be tossed to the side so swiftly. These supports that we all agree our children need just disappear like pencils in a kindergarten classroom, but our children's needs don't go anywhere. They don't become neurotypical because we will it so. Our EC teachers who had difficult jobs before, balancing incredible paperwork demands with equally demanding students, are at their breaking points. Many of them choose to be in the general education classroom or leave education altogether. Our EC system is in crisis, and a group of students who are already so vulnerable are paying the price. It's especially concerning because having a disability is not mutually exclusive with having other marginalized identities. In fact, so many of our disabled students in DPS are also Black, Brown, gender, and sexual minorities, and or have limited English proficiency. As a parent, it's hard to know what to do. Your child has rights, they said. You have rights. I'm thankful for the organizing power of Every Child NC in advocating for the rights of every child, but the reality is that it's just not enough. We can't keep waiting on a state legislature that refuses to prioritize our most marginalized students. As a parent and education advocate, I've been happy to work with the People's Alliance in advocating for differential pay for our EC teachers, to acknowledge the value of the extra work and responsibilities that come with their position. This alone won't dig us out of the crisis we're in, but we also can't keep things the way they are when only 17% of students with disabilities are proficient on state exams and a whopping 33% don't graduate with their cohort. Jenny Jones Coldren wrote that op-ed. And another DPS-related article, shootings near Brogdon Middle School rattles parents. After fatal shootings on March 21st near Brogdon Middle School, in which two teenagers were killed and a third injured, members of the DPS community are grappling with how to move forward. The shooting near Brogdon is the second fatal shooting connected to Durham Public Schools in 1 month, after a teen was killed near Hillside High in February. According to WRAL, DPS high school students Angel Canales and Osmar Benegas were killed in the Brogdon shooting. A third teen has not been identified. Pascal Mubenga, DPS superintendent, says once again, Durham Public Schools have been touched by gun violence. We have to ask ourselves the hard question, what has changed in our community? We have to face it, then we have to answer it with what our community is going to do about it. Sarah Dawson, a Brogdon parent and psychotherapist specializing in trauma treatment, says the school administration can improve how it responds to emergencies. Dawson said parents and students arrived on March 22nd to Brogdon to discover police on the scene. Police instructed parents to drop off their children in front of the building due to the active crime scene in the back. Helicopters circled overhead. According to Dawson, when the lockdown ended, teachers discouraged students from talking about what happened or checking their phones. As students went to class and took exams, it was unclear whether there was still an active threat on campus. Dawson said, telling someone they're safe, while all their external sensory information says otherwise, is confusing and ultimately trust-breaking. I think we could do better to insulate our children. DPS Chairwoman Bettina Umstead said school administrators are collaborating on a response plan. Quote, I've spoken to some of our city and county officials. We're considering what to do to keep our students engaged, engaged in learning, engaged in work experiences, and engaged in joy, said Umstead. Community members emphasized the need for ongoing communication with students. Walter Bloom, a parent of three DPS students, called for a day of mourning to honor the lives of the students who were lost. Quote, they need to hear your words that you spoke to this boardroom in the light of the shootings that are going on. This tragedy will happen again if we don't do anything, if we follow a process that doesn't imply more than business as usual. Shelley Rudy, another parent, said more trauma counselors are needed at the school for both students and staff. She said, it's unfair what we're asking of our teachers right now. It's unfair the burden we're putting on them post-COVID to keep our students safe and teach them in a time of such deep mental health crisis. According to DPS Chief Financial Officer Paul LeSueur, the current ratio of mental health counselors to students in the school system is approximately 1 to 276. Board member Genovia Lewis stressed the importance of supporting mental health services as the board continues to review the budget for the next school year. Quote, if we're asking for more, I really want us to center our mental health support. I think we have a lot of needs and a lot of requests. The worst they could say is no. Next, from Carrie, Will Atwater's column, Good Earth. Carrie's Good Hope Farm manager, Thomas Sale, appreciated a recent warm spell. Quote, this week we had some nice warm weather and were able to get our first tilling in for the season, which breaks up last crop residue and helps with drainage and aeration. After that, we began applying our compost to the field. Establishing healthy soil is an important first step in the process of growing vegetables. Adding decomposed organic matter, compost, to soil infuses it with nutrients plants need to produce high-quality vegetables. Fortunately, Good Hope Farm has a new source of compost this year. In 2022, the town of Cary established a pilot food waste drop-off program to divert food waste from the landfill and create new compost now used at Good Hope Farm. The response surpassed expectations, and according to a release, the pilot's initial goal of collecting a minimum of 16 tons of food scraps resulted in an actual collection of 40 tons. Despite early success, Assistant Town Manager Dana Widmar knows that more buy-in is needed to grow the program. She says, while we continue to see increased use, we know not everyone was an early adopter. We encourage citizens to try it out if they haven't yet. Diverting food waste from landfills is a goal Widmar shares with the global environmental and scientific communities, which are concerned about the connections between food waste, a warming planet, and environmental and health problems. Food waste buried in landfills breaks down in an oxygen-deprived environment. It produces methane as a byproduct. Recently, NC Policy Watch reported that Sampson County Landfill ranks number 2 in the nation for methane emissions. And Nora Goldstein, a composting expert, says, depending on whether you're measuring by a year or 20 years, methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. In addition to methane, landfill deposited food waste produces 170 million metric tons of carbon dioxide emissions. That matches the yearly output of 42 coal-fired power plants. 42 coal-fired power plants, according to an EPA report, which also states food waste is the single most common material landfilled and incinerated in the U.S., comprising 24 and 22% of landfilled and combusted municipal solid waste. Additionally, the food loss and waste represent 8% of human-generated greenhouse gas emissions each year, 8%. Researchers have warned that climate change will threaten world economies by disrupting product supply chains, reducing global food production, and causing mass population displacement, among other negative impacts. The effects on human health are predicted to include increased respiratory, cardiovascular disease, more diseases transmitted from insects, and more heat-related deaths and other negative outcomes. The North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, that's DEQ, has a map on its website that shows the location of compost facilities across the state. There are more than 50 sites on the map, representing a mixture of private and government-run composting facilities, but it's not clear how many of those compost food waste. In addition, DEQ provides approximately $400,000 in grant fund support to local governments, nonprofits, and business to help divert food waste from landfills. The funding opportunities are made available on an annual basis. One facility that's listed on DEQ's North Carolina Food Donation and Compost Resource Map is roughly 250 miles west and slightly south of Good Hope Farm in Henderson County. The Henderson County Convenience Center is where residents can drop off recyclables. The county operates a transfer station and ships its garbage across the border to a landfill in South Carolina, paying roughly $40 per ton, according to Amy Schmidt, County Environmental Coordinator. In 2017, the Convenience Center began a food waste drop-off program, and by 2022, the facility had diverted 142 tons of food waste from the landfill. Though the current savings is less than 1% of the waste management budget, the county continues to work toward expanding that facility and diverting more food waste from the landfill. Schmidt said, "We accept typical food waste, but we can accept some other items. You won't typically be able to compost at home, which is nice for folks." Through a process known as aerated static pile composting, air is pumped from perforated pipes beneath the compost pile. This air stimulates oxygen-craving beneficial organisms that feed on the waste. During this process, the pile's core temperature reaches 131 degrees for a 10-day period, which is hot enough to kill pathogens, even those found in meat scraps and dairy products. Pizza boxes and other paper items are also composted. Currently, the only outlet for the finished compost is the grounds of the solid waste transfer site. Schmidt says that additional testing is needed to ensure that all pathogens are eliminated during composting before other outlets are considered. Another food waste composter, Brooks Contractor in Goldston, is a private business that uses windrows to transform food scraps into compost for its clients. Amy Brooks, assistant facility manager, said that on average it takes about 1 year to produce compost. She said the process involves mixing food waste with wood waste, animal bedding, and leaves. Once the ingredients are mixed, they are spread out into windrows, where they are turned at least 5 times over a 3 to 6 month period. During this time, the pile's internal temperature must surpass that 131 degrees. To ensure that pathogens are killed. Afterwards, the windrow is moved to a curing pile. Later, after a screening process that removes clumps and debris, the compost is ready to be sold. North Carolinians who don't live in communities that offer food waste composting can establish a home composting system. For those who have yard space, there are plenty of bins and tumblers on the market that range in size and price. Good Hope Farm offers composting workshops and sells containers that will produce roughly 1 cubic yard of compost. Sal says this container would be something that someone could put in their backyard. It's got a nice little lid. It's got a stirring tool that comes with it to keep it aerated, and this is perfect for a general household. Sale also encourages first-time composters to take a workshop because there's a few ways you can go wrong. The pile can get too wet, or it can be too much green nitrogen or too much brown carbon, which slows down the decay of the food scraps. However, Sale says when a bin is properly layered, the pile only needs to be turned occasionally to promote the composting process. Goldstein warns, however, to avoid adding meat, fish, or dairy to your backyard bin because the temperatures in your compost don't get hot enough to destroy pathogens. Companies like Compost Now, which is in Raleigh, provide a food waste collection service for a fee and accept meat and dairy scraps, often in exchange for access to compost for household use. Many householders are put off by collecting compost in the kitchen, which can also collect insects that are drawn by countertop food waste connectors. One way to avoid that, store food scraps in a bag in the freezer till you're ready to add them to the outdoor bin. While Goldstein is encouraged by the growing number of municipalities that establish food waste drop-off, she would like to see things move at a faster pace. Especially since, quote, given what we know about the challenges of food waste in the landfill. Good article, informative. I have time for some statewide shorter articles from IndyWeek. And the first, Representative Tricia Cotham formally announced she's switching parties to become a Republican. Cotham bashed Democrats at a news conference Wednesday where Republicans welcomed her to the GOP. Cotham said Democrats had bullied her, shunned her, tried to tell her what to do, and called her a traitor when she was selected to co-lead a House Education Committee. Quote, they've pushed me out. They've made it very clear they don't want me. She said she'd only attended one House caucus meeting this session. Democrats used to be a big tent party, she said, but now discourage independent thought. Quote, the party wants to villainize anyone who has free thought, free judgment, and solutions, who wants to get to work and better our state and not just sit in a meeting and have a workshop after a workshop. House Democratic leader Robert Reeves' office did not respond to an email seeking comment, but anticipating what Cotham would say, North Carolina League of Conservation Voters sent an email Tuesday saying Cotham betrayed the voters of her heavily Democratic district. Statement from Director of Government Relations, Dan Crawford. Tomorrow, Tricia Cotham is going to lie to the voters in District 112 and claim a political party betrayed her and gave her no other choice. However, Tricia is the one committing an act of betrayal, and that is to the voters who fulfilled their civic voting to vote and chose to vote for her. Turncoat Tricia needs to have the courage of her convictions and resign and let the people who elected her make a worthy replacement that represents the values they voted for in November. By Tuesday afternoon's House session, her seat on the House floor was moved to the Republican side. House Republicans now have 72 caucus members and enough votes to overturn Governor Cooper's vetoes if they all stick together. Senate Republicans already have a veto-proof majority. Democrats' power to sustain Cooper's vetoes was already weak. His veto of a bill loosening gun laws was overturned last week when three Democrats were absent from the override vote that included Cotham. The absences gave Republicans their needed 3/5 majority. Republicans this session are working through a list of priorities that in the last 4 years had been stymied by vetoes. Republicans are acting on voter restrictions, expanded school vouchers, restrictions on public school teachers' talk about racism, and requirements for teachers to post online lesson plans and course materials. House Speaker Tim Moore did not want to say much about issues where Cotton's party switch would make a difference. His goal this session was to work with centrist Democrats to build agreements that would win bipartisan support, he said. The party switch is a remarkable turnaround for the Mecklenburg County representative who rested on her reputation as a public school supporter when she first joined the House in 2007 as a former classroom teacher and administrator. Most of the bills she sponsored in her first two sessions dealt with school issues. When addressing education issues on Wednesday, she talked about charters. On issues like school choice and charters, we have to evolve. One size fits all is wrong for children. She also supported reproductive rights. In 2013, she voted against a law that prevents insurance purchased through Affordable Care Act from covering abortion, prevents local governments from covering abortions, and requires doctors be present when women take their first dose of abortion pills. In 2015, she voted against abortion restrictions. Before voting against the bill, she spoke of her own abortion of a non-viable pregnancy. She now joins a House caucus that's debating further limits on abortion rights. At the conference, she refused to say what she thought about proposed abortion bans after 6 weeks or 12 weeks. Three Republicans have filed a bill banning most abortions at conception. That bill is not expected to become law. Cotham said, "I'm not going to give any type of number. If you go back into my history, you'll know I was never someone that this was the biggest issue facing women in North Carolina. I believe women are much more." She said she would research an abortion bill, talk to others. "I will have these internal dialogues very, very much." Equality gave her its Legislative Leadership Award in 2013, calling her a champion for equality and LGBT issues. The recognition says he was a leading opponent of a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage and civil unions. Joining the Republican news conference was Representative Dan Bishop, a Republican known in the state for sponsoring what was known as the bathroom bill, which required transgender people use public bathrooms that matched the gender on their birth certificates. Bishop said he and Cotham have been friends for years, although they've had disagreements over political issues from time to time. "I'm glad to be here with my friend today," Bishop said. "I think Tricia is making the right decision. She's a strong woman and a strong leader." And that's all I will read from excerpt from this article. Next, the North Carolina Supreme Court has not yet ruled on whether a voter ID law was intended to discriminate against prospective voters of color. But that didn't stop House Republicans from funding it. They released a budget proposal last week that would give $3.5 million to the State Board of Elections to implement voter ID requirements. The board would also be required to report to the legislature how they used the money on February 1st and May 1st of 2024. The status of this law, passed by the legislature in 2018, is uncertain. The NC Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional last year, with the court's Democratic judges finding the statute, quote, was enacted with discriminatory intent to disproportionately disenfranchise and burden African-American voters in North Carolina. But then, the Democrats lost control of the Supreme Court in last year's elections, giving Republicans a 5-2 majority. The new majority then agreed to reconsider the case. The justices heard oral arguments last month. Pete Patterson, an attorney for Republican lawmakers, said the previous court had erred in its ruling, that the opinion had been decided hastily since the case skipped the Court of Appeals and oral arguments before the state Supreme Court were expedited. Patterson said legislatures hadn't meant to discriminate against African-American voters because everybody could cast a ballot under the law as long as they presented a photo ID. He also noted there were provisions in the law allowing for free IDs at early voting locations, and that even those who don't vote with an ID have 10 days to go to a county board of elections, get their photograph taken, and have their ballot counted. In short, Patterson argued lawmakers had enacted the narrowest possible racial disparity in terms of a voter ID law. The Supreme Court has yet to issue its ruling on the law's constitutionality. My clock gives me about 7.5 minutes to read some more, and I will switch over now to some music column by Nick McGregor concerning Durham's Chessie Rich, who's breaking out with Deeper Sleeper. She's been dreaming of this moment for years. First came the metaphorical dreams. She began writing the songs on Deeper Sleeper in fits and starts in 2017, eventually recording the debut album in March of 21. But it took 2 more years until the project emerged from its cocoon, dropping this Friday, tomorrow, on Sleepy Cat Records. That long stretch aligns with a period of difficult yet vivid dreaming, during which Rich suffered from undiagnosed sleep apnea. It's a condition that causes a person's breathing to stop and start throughout the night, preventing the body from getting enough oxygen. In some cases, it induces intense, often terrifying dreams. In others, it causes persistent fatigue. Rich was unlucky enough to suffer a sucker punch of both symptoms. She told Indie Week, "Not sleeping and being tired all the time affects your mood and changes your relationships to people, work, and creativity. Everything feels more stressful." Finally, undergoing a sleep test after a lifetime of unsettled rest, Rich received relief, a medical diagnosis that delivered a modicum of self-acceptance, along with a prescription for a CPAP machine to sleep better. "It was super helpful," she laughs, "to realize that I'm not just lazy." But struggling for so long to interpret the surreal symbolism of her dreams while cultivating a career as a working musician who needs 11 hours of sleep a night gave the 34-year-old Burlington native and decade-long Durham resident a single perspective on making it. "I got so used to waking up and feeling the same amount of tired as I did when I went to bed," Rich says. "Our culture is all about that rise-and-grind entrepreneur mindset, working, exercising, socializing, partying. But it doesn't have to be that way. Learning I had sleep apnea allowed me to be more gracious with myself." Deeper Sleeper's 9 tracks are awash in such benevolence. Recorded outside Woodstock, New York, at Milan Hill Studios with producer Shane Leonard, the album is primarily built around catchy piano riffs, that instrument that Rich grew up playing. A tight-knit circle of North Carolina friends, Saman Kujinian, Joseph Terrell, Alex Bingham, and Jay Hammond, helped her flesh out those compositions with elegant instrumentation. I will skip ahead now through a tune-by-tune commentary on the tunes by Chessie Rich and go on, and you can find those by visiting indieweek.com for their free online issue. But anyway, it says her upcoming album release show on April 29th at Cat's Cradle is sponsored by WUNC, and she's elated to get back on stage after a multi-month break. Yet she's candid regarding her anxiety about careerist considerations, marketing, promotion, video budgets, licensing, interviews, and the dreaded social media content making. She says, "Creative energy to me is a physical thing. I like moving my body on stage with other people. So this promo mode has been messing with my brain. When I'm not playing shows and only living on the internet, I feel terrible." Asked about other musical pursuits that bring her joy, she goes deep, jamming with her church band on Sundays, watching her dad play trombone in the Elon University Wind Ensemble, and teaching music lessons, her main source of income over the last few years, while also a clear inspiration. She says, "I want my students to understand how music can help them live in the world. I like to work around their idiosyncrasies and what they want to say. That reminds me how to make my own music and helps me stay in the right mindset." Another mental trick? Rich's Morning Pages, a practice inspired by Julia Cameron, author of The Artist's Way, and captured in loving detail in the video for the song called Julia. the placid rumination on creativity blooms into deserved self-actualization. Why have I been trying so hard? Rich croons, befriend the things that follow me around and redesign the present for the making. The painter is the creation, not the painting. Those lines provide a direct connection to Deeper Sleeper's final track, Mary, which honors Rich's grandmother. She had 9 children, Rich marvels, but still painted strictly for enjoyment for decades. In 2018, after celebrating the 2019 release of Rich's first EP, Rich's mother gifted her one of those paintings to remind Chessie of her own artistic power. It made me so emotional to be connected to my grandmother like that, she says. I'm a continuation of her art, but I never get to talk to her about it. Tearing up, she continues, I want to ask her all these questions. Why did you paint? How did you paint? What made you want to paint? And toward the end of Mary, Rich threads her own existential questions with those her grandmother may have asked herself. When she sings, I've been recalling more things. My lifetime is in the palm of my hand. The strength of this generational thread, and the fascinating way she wraps her voice around the word palm, cuts deep. In her affable, disarming manner, Rich shrugs off some deliberations. When I started this process, I had a weird relationship with songwriting where I feel I didn't deserve to do this. I wasn't ready 2 or 3 years ago to step up and step out like this. Even after recording Deeper Sleeper, I sat on it for 8 months. I wasn't able to release it then. Still, she isn't afraid to admit that this moment, that dream state she stands on the edge of, is scary. Sometimes I wish I had done this 10 years ago, she laughs, but I'm ready now. Well, here comes my little music to indicate that I'm ready now to close Indie Week for this broadcast and remind everybody that after the initial show, which happens on Friday afternoon, it'll be available on the podcast section. John Federson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Hope that you'll join me next week for another edition of Indie Week. Thanks for listening, everybody, from the North Carolina Reading Service. So long.